It is Monday, August 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Obama unveils a plan to sharply reduce emissions from the nation's power plants, setting up a fight with some parts of the power industry. We'll take you to northern Iraq, where minority Yazidis are marking 1 year since Islamic State militants began driving them from their homes.
Many died of thirst and hunger when we were stranded on the mountains. God.
And the killing of a rare lion in Zimbabwe puts the sport of trophy hunting in the global spotlight. It's all ahead on International Edition. President Obama has formally announced new regulations aimed at reducing carbon pollution that comes from America's power plants. His Clean Power Plan would reduce U.S. reliance on coal-fired electricity and move the country further toward renewable energy sources. Mr. Obama presented the plan at the White House on Monday, alongside Gina McCarthy, director of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA.
2 years ago, I directed Gina and the Environmental Protection Agency to take on this challenge. And today, after working with states and cities and power companies, the EPA is setting the first ever nationwide standards to end the limitless dumping of carbon pollution from power plants.
Well, under those standards, U.S. power plants must reduce their carbon emissions by 32% below 2005 levels by the year 2030. David Doniger is a clean air advocate at the U.S. environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council. My colleague Jeffrey Young spoke to him today and asked Doniger how technologically difficult it will be to meet Mr. Obama's target.
It's totally doable. Many of the states are already a good way along towards that goal. Power companies have been bringing in cleaner energy resources. The renewable energy and energy efficiency have been growing very fast in this country, so these targets are totally reachable.
But I understand that there are a number of states that already are talking out loud about challenging this. In fact, according to the news story that the Voice of America put out, legal challenges to the regulations are expected from as many as 25 states. In some of those cases, maybe winding up before the U.S. Supreme Court. Why would states be fighting this so vigorously?
The main opponents are the coal industry and just a portion of the power industry that just are resisting the change. And they do have powerful political allies. So there are some state officials who are going to join them in these challenges. But I'm very confident that EPA is on solid legal ground under the Clean Air Act.
It also says that individual states will be responsible for coming up with their own plans to meet these targets, but that under this new plan being put out now, they would get 2 more years to do so. In other words, it would go in effect by 2022. Can we count on states to actually come up with actionable plans?
Most states will come up with their own good plans, because they understand that at the state and local level, that's the best place to identify all the smart ways to comply, things that build up jobs, things that help the economy of the state. But the Clean Air Act provides that if a state doesn't want to do it, the job falls directly to the EPA to regulate the power plants directly. These are national pollution control obligations. And states are invited to write their own plans, but the power plants are still subject to carbon limits, even if the states don't play.
One U.S. senator from Florida, Marco Rubio, remarked over this past weekend that China and India and other developing countries are going to continue to burn anything that they can get their hands on. In other words, he's inferring, why should the United States throttle down its coal-fired power plants when there's other countries that are burning coal like crazy and polluting the skies? What about them?
Well, China and India and other countries are actually very responsive to U.S. leadership. What they really want to see is the United States serious about this? And already, President Obama has been able to negotiate significant changes in China, significant changes in Brazil and Mexico, and working still with India. The fact is, when the U.S. leads, other countries take note, and they follow. When the U.S. lags behind, the whole thing falls apart.
And that was David Doniger, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he was speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Well, let's turn to the social media reaction to the announcement. As always, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio with the latest. So, G, what was the reaction on social media?
Hi, Michael. So, President Obama sent out 7 tweets in total after the announcement, and here's the first one from 3 hours ago. Mr. Obama wrote, "Today we're announcing America's clean power plan, the most important step we have ever taken to combat climate change. Here are the facts." That's been retweeted more than 4,000 times and marked as a favorite more than 8,000 times. He went on to lay out some of the facts to support the plan. He wrote that by 2030, carbon pollution from power plants will go down significantly, and there will be 90,000 fewer asthma attacks among children. And he added, families will also save on energy bills. President Obama is on Twitter at POTUS.
Well, what did POTUS say in his last tweet of the day?
Well, the last one was more motivational than factual. He wrote, "I refuse to condemn our kids to a planet that's beyond fixing. Let's meet this challenge and hashtag act on climate together."
Well, how popular was that hashtag?
Quite popular, because it was used in about 24,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. But hashtag clean power plan was used even more and was a worldwide trending hashtag on Twitter. More than 35,000 tweets used that hashtag.
Right, so that the name of the plan had more tweets than the other slogan the administration was using, right?
Exactly. So before I go, I want to add that the White House shared clips from Mr. Obama's announcement today, and its handle is at White House.
Great. Well, thank you for that update, G. That was G. Abby Lee. And if you want to follow her on Twitter, she is at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon recently visited Norway in an attempt to raise awareness of the upcoming climate change conference.
This looks magnificent, but at the same time, I'm alarmed that there are so many cracks in may soon break. They are melting very rapidly.
The United States, European Union, and China announced their proposed carbon pledges for the conference. But Samantha Smith of the World Wildlife Fund says via Skype, the pledges don't go far enough.
There's already a big gap between what's needed to really fight climate change and what many countries and industries are doing today. We do need to see more urgency, more political will, not necessarily just from the United Nations, but actually from the countries that are doing the negotiations.
Member nations will meet in Paris later this year to try to sign off on a new international carbon-cutting agreement. For VOA's Greenbeat, I'm Rebecca Ward.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Greece took another step toward restoring the normal functioning of its troubled economy on Monday when its stock market reopened for the first time in 5 weeks. But share prices tumbled in Athens as Greeks try to emerge from a major debt crisis. Earlier, I spoke with International Edition's business correspondent Alexis Christophorus in New York and asked her how bad the sell-off was.
Well, the Greek stock market saw the most dramatic wave of selling in decades after the exchange opened for the first time in 5 weeks. We saw bank stocks lead that plunge. They were down about 30%, and that's the daily maximum allowed by the Athens Stock Exchange. The benchmark ASE index sank about 16% in Athens after sliding as much as 23%. And adding insult to injury, Greece's manufacturing industry shrank at a record pace last month as we saw demand collapse. So all of these things work together to have investors really running for the exits the moment they had access to their money in the stock market. You'll remember the Greek government was forced to shut down banks, its stock market, and impose capital controls in late June before ultimately accepting a deal for bridge financing to avoid defaulting.
Right. And something else that fell today, although perhaps not as much, was the price of oil at a four-month low. So what's going on with that?
That's right. Crude oil closing at $45.17 a barrel. And we saw Brent fall 4.5% to $49.84 a barrel. It's the same old story, unfortunately, a sort of a perfect storm here, a worldwide oil glut, uncertainty over economic growth, combining to send oil futures to a fresh four-month low. Oil was vulnerable to further pressure after last week's downbeat assessment from ExxonMobil and Chevron, and also a rise in the U.S. oil rig count. And add in weak economic data from China over the weekend, and you've got a lot of pressure on prices.
Something else that might have been pressuring prices are comments from the Iranian oil minister. What did he have to say?
That's right. Iran's oil minister says that within a week of sanctions being lifted, his country can comfortably increase oil production by 500,000 barrels a day and by 1 million barrels a day within a month's time. And also, as an aside, Iran says it plans to buy as many as 90 planes per year from Boeing and Airbus to revamp its antiquated fleet once Western sanctions are finally lifted. And Iran plans to finance those purchases through leasing, foreign loans, and state funding.
Well, Alexis Christophorus in New York, our business correspondent there, thanks so much for updating us on the latest business news.
Thanks, Michael.
Well, on to the Middle East now. 1 year ago on August 3rd, Islamic State militants stormed the homelands of Iraq's Yazidi minority, killing hundreds of men and enslaving thousands of women. Yazidi families crowded onto the top of Iraq's Sinjar Mountain without food or water, desperate scenes that spurred Kurdish fighters into action to defend them. Those scenes also triggered an emergency U.S. airlift of aid to the Yazidis, as well as a U.S. campaign of airstrikes against the Sunni IS extremists. VOA's Sharon Bain has more from northern Iraq.
Yazidis who survived the massacre are scattered around the region. This small community is resting from the heat in the shade of a famous Yazidi shrine at Lalish in northern Iraq. The images of what happened 12 months ago are seared into their minds.
We had one camp full of water for two children. There was no food, no water. Many died of thirst and hunger when we were stranded on the mountains. God.
IS militants raped Yazidi girls, enslaved thousands of others, and executed the men, says Sheikh Ismail Qasim, another survivor.
This is the end of our people. They have massacred us in the thousands, raped 8- and 9-year-old girls, the future of our Yazidi community, and now they are all killed.
A year after the massacre, thousands of Yazidis are lost, says Hadi Baba Sheikh, spokesman for the group's religious leader.
Still thousands of Yazidis are displaced and are scattered across the cities of Kurdistan and Iraq, Syria and Turkey. Thousands have fled their ancestral lands, and thousands of women and children are enslaved by ISIS.
Yazidi spiritual leader Baba Sheikh called for help.
We call for the protection of the Yazidis. We are alone. We have no one to turn to, and we pray.
With the Islamic State militants still controlling large tracts of Iraq, no one here knows when they will be able to return to their lands. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Lalish, Iraq.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
New research from Australia's University of Adelaide is providing evidence that plants, which don't have a nervous system like animals, transmit animal-like signals when they're under stress. The findings show that plants respond to stress in their environment with a combination of chemical and electrical signals that are similar to those emitted by animals under stress. Senior author Matthew Gillingham, a professor at the Australian University, says that it's been long known that an animal neurotransmitter, GABA, is also produced by plants when they encounter stress such as drought, salinity, viruses, acidic soils, or extreme temperatures. The researchers made their findings when they noticed that a plant's neuroreceptors connected with its corresponding GABA neurotransmitters in a way that's similar in animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. A second American has been accused by Zimbabwean authorities of illegally killing a lion in recent months. The announcement follows Zimbabwe's request that Washington extradite a Midwestern U.S. dentist, Walter Palmer, for the alleged poaching of a rare black-maned lion named Cecil as a trophy. As VOA's Victor Beatty reports, the killings have generated an international debate about trophy hunting.
Appearing Sunday on U.S. television, conservationist Jack Hanna, director emeritus of the Columbus, Ohio Zoo, says the lion population has dwindled dramatically in the past 70 years.
In 1947, when I was born, there were about 450,000 lions. In the mid-70s, when my kids were born, there were about 100,000. Today, there are less than 30,000.
Hanna was asked if it's time to put an end to so-called trophy hunting, the selective hunting of wild game animals in which part of the slain animal, such as the skin, antlers, or head, is kept as a hunting trophy.
I think this issue has to be looked at immediately, considering the loss of the lions to 30,000 now. We've got to take some of these animals that might be plentiful somewhere and put these animals in other areas where they need these animals.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it is investigating the Palmer case, and comments have flooded the Twitter hashtag Cecil Lion. The dentist has not been seen in public since the story made news last week. His office is closed, and he has reportedly been the object of death threats. Friday, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner declined to discuss Zimbabwe's request that Palmer be sent there for trial.
I can more broadly talk about extradition and how that process works, if it's helpful. They are received by the Department of State through diplomatic channels, and state works closely with the Department of Justice to determine whether an incoming extradition request meets the requirements of the applicable treaty.
Jens David Olin, a Cornell University law professor, says Palmer could be extraditable if what is alleged in Zimbabwe can also be considered a crime here in the United States, punishable by at least 1 year in prison. But Olin says there are further legal tools Palmer can use.
Well, I think that there's two levels. The first is he can lobby the Justice Department and he can lobby the State Department, or his lawyers can, and ask them to block the extradition request and to not comply with it. But assuming that the State Department and the Justice Department decide that they want to comply with the extradition request, even if that happens, Palmer's lawyers still have an avenue available to them, which is they can fight extradition after he's been arrested in the United States. The process for him is that he would be arrested, he'd be brought to a local court. At that point, instead of waiving extradition, he could contest it, and he could say that there's some defect in the process.
In Washington, U.S. Senator Robert Menendez has introduced legislation called Conserving Ecosystems by Ceasing the Importation of Large, or CECL, Animal Trophies Act. It would expand import bans to species proposed for listing as threatened or endangered, as well as those already considered endangered. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
And now for some entertainment. In hip-hop music, authenticity is a big deal. But a recent conflict between American hip-hop artist Meek Mill and Toronto-based MC Drake has flared over whether Drake writes all his rhymes. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Sean Renee to find out more.
Let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
Okay. Meek Mill, who...
In the beginning, there was the Meek one.
There was the Meek one, who, better known as Nicki Minaj's boyfriend.
Okay.
For people who may not be into contemporary hip-hop music.
All right.
Anyway, he has a new project, and Drake, who almost everyone knows, he's hugely successful, Drake did a cameo on the project. And so Meek Mill was a little upset about the fact that Drake did not promote the project the way that, according to Meek Mill, they had originally agreed he would.
Mm-hmm.
And so he took to Twitter and said, you know, I'm angry with Drake essentially for not promoting it, but the reason he didn't promote it is because Drake doesn't write his own rhymes.
Okay.
That's like the worst thing you could say about...
Now, Meek said this about
artist.
Drake.
This is what Meek said about Drake.
And I understand it's only like one verse that was in dispute or something.
On his record. But he kind of implied that it wasn't just the verse on Meek's record that was not written by Drake, but implied that it was also, there were also verses on some of his own, meaning Drake's records, that had not been written by Drake.
Now, why is this a beef, though? I mean, singers have been singing other people's words for, you know, centuries.
Right. Well, in hip-hop, it's a little different. You can kind of look at hip-hop the way you would poetry. So it is a very personal expression of someone's experience, someone's feeling. It is. It started off as being and continues to be in its purest form authentic.
Right.
Authenticity is very important, as you said in the beginning. So while it has always also been a collaborative process, most hip-hop artists, most hip-hop writers, people who write raps, do so about their own experiences and wouldn't necessarily hand it over to someone else to do. Now that hip-hop has become more popular and people are writing hits as opposed to just writing songs, you will have folks who know what it takes to create a hit come in and write verses.
Ghostwriting.
Yeah, ghostwriting.
They called it ghosting.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Drake was being accused of. But Drake has come out.
Ghosting instead of toasting.
Instead of toasting. Right, there you go. Such a funny man. But so, yeah, so that's why it's a huge deal, because Drake does present himself as someone who is authentic.
All right. Well, we will see if the beef continues. If you have any comments about this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. And you can send us a tweet at VOA underscore IE. Listen also for Shauna in the Soul Lounge on www.voanews.com.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we're here.
And that's it for today's international edition on The Voice of America. You can find us on voanews.com by clicking on the Programs tab at the top, then scrolling down and clicking on the link to the International Edition program page. My thanks to Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Zahra Abu Zaid. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. You can find me on Twitter at Michael underscore Lippin. And the show is there too at VOA underscore IE. Bye for now.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the U.S. State Department reviews efforts by foreign governments to combat human trafficking. The use of children as soldiers by nations and armed groups is an egregious form of this crime and is a special concern. While the unlawful recruitment and use of child soldiers is a global phenomenon, the 2015 Human Trafficking Report indicates, as it has in the past, that the practice is most critical in Asia and Africa. Children are often abducted, or at times sold, to be used as combatants. In addition to participating in combat-related activities, children are sometimes forced to engage in hazardous activities, such as laying mines, and are frequently killed or wounded. Some have been forced to commit atrocities, and most suffer psychological scarring. Both female and male child soldiers are often sexually abused, or at high risk of contracting sexually transmitted diseases. In 2008, our nation enacted a law that requires the Secretary of State to identify countries that have governmental armed forces or government-supported armed groups that recruit and use child soldiers. The law requires that the Secretary of State compile and publish a list of those countries in the annual trafficking report. These countries then face legal restrictions on access to certain types of U.S. military assistance and training. Eight countries were listed this year: Syria, Burma, Sudan, Somalia, South Sudan, Nigeria, Yemen, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Listed last year, the transitional government of the Central African Republic and Rwanda are making progress to reduce the recruitment and use of child soldiers and weren't included on the sanctions and restrictions list. The sale and trafficking of children and their entrapment in any form must be eradicated, and their unlawful recruitment for labor or sexual exploitation in conflict areas must be stopped. All nations must work together with international organizations and non-governmental organizations to take urgent action to disarm, demobilize, and reintegrate unlawful child soldiers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.